worsen, and Mumia is now barely able to eat, stand, or keep awake. He is just 61. Mumia's supporters are urging phone calls to Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections John Wetzel at 717-728-2573. That's 717-728-2573. And to Governor Tom Wolf at 717-787-2500. That's 717-787-2500. The demand is to allow Mumia Abu-Jamal to receive medical attention from volunteer specialist doctors who stand by ready to assist. Today, a group of activists also delivered a detailed letter to Governor Wolf demanding action. It was signed by many organizations and individuals, including Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Congressmember Charles Rangel, actor Danny Glover, Professor Cornel West, and Minister Louis Farrakhan, among others. For updates, visit freemumia.com and prisonradio.org.
joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, and I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine. Plowmen dig my earth. But none of them along the line know what any of this is worth.
by flowering fields? Is there a time? What about all the dreams that you said was yours and mine? Did you ever stop to notice all the children dead from war? Did you ever stop to notice this crying earth?
You are tuned to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. This is Earth at Midnight, or maybe 1210 would be a better word. Well, that Warrior Wednesday is a phenomenon. It's an amazing group of young people. And I used to think that this was a fairly big studio, but there are so many that come through and, you know, share their poetry, their words, and their thoughts and music. It's really an amazing group of young people that have joined the WBAI family with Warrior Wednesday. So we find that a little music gives us that transitional space to come in and settle in and get started and make an attempt to figure out what we're going to talk about today. And so this program has really developed itself into a almost like a fireside chat, except there's the only fire is the fire of spirit. There is no actual physical flame here. But it's really a wonderful thing to be able to sit peer to peer. And when I say that, I mean you, our listeners, as our peers, because in truth, we all have experiences to share. We all have something to say about our lives, about the world, and we can learn from each other. And I really enjoy this format of engaging in a conversation and sharing ideas and really opening up to each other's perspectives. And I would say that that's true of myself and Paulette. We have different perspectives on many things, though we are in essence, you know, coming from a good place and agree on a lot of things as well. So it's interesting because we have a different perspective. I consider myself to be a little bit more of, I won't say radical, but I think that my ideas and my understanding of things tends to be a little bit more, I won't even say it's left. It isn't left. It isn't right. It's just very esoteric. Maybe that would be the word to say. You know, sort of stratospheric. It's not the dealings of life in a way that I grew up learning to deal with life. I deal with life in a very different way. And, you know, it serves me, so I guess that's why it works for me. And you can speak for yourself in terms of your perspective and how you view things. To me, if I were to, from my bird's eye view, it seems to me that you're a very grounded person, very much looking at the real world as it really is. That's how I see your perspective. How would you characterize your perspective on things?
I think I'm a mixture. Mm-hmm. I think I'm a hybrid.
Ah.
Because I think that there's, for a long, long time in my life, I mean, I really want to understand how the world works. And, I mean, that was my kind of love for political science when I was younger, and understanding how the world sees us. So I was constantly reaching out to understand, well, it's one thing when you say you're great, but let's see what other people say. Mm-hmm. So that's how I really kind of got into that aspect of it. But in the process, you know, getting a lot more familiar and connected to so many people that I've met from every corner of the globe, I think I had an appreciation for the human family way before then, but it really, I would say, strengthened it even more. Mm-hmm. Understanding how power relationships are in the real world, so to speak, and also seeing the people who are affected by it and meeting them and realizing that we're not necessarily part of the people that pull the strings. We're just the people that they're trying to influence.
Mm-hmm.
And we're above that.
Okay, that's cool. Well, see, yeah, I could see what you're saying in terms of, you know, it's not just about the mechanics of the world. It's about a real deeper understanding of how things are going, and, you know, the struggle, the human struggle.
Absolutely.
That people have on the planet. So I guess in that way we have great similarities.
I always thought so.
Yeah. Well, no, I felt so too. But I guess I have a tendency to think of myself as being, and maybe it's, you know, a delusion, I don't know, but I think of myself as being, I think that I'm very much grounded in the earth, in the physical earth, in the energy of the earth. I don't feel very grounded in the society of the earth or the politics of the earth. So I don't have a great interest in politics. I don't have a great interest in, you know, the arguments that rise up between factions of policies and politics. I don't really see the great differences that people see between democracy and fascism. I don't see the differences between communism and socialism. You know, so people argue the fine points of all these different perspectives. I don't really see them as being very different from each other. So I get lost in the fine points, because to me they're just a way of people trying to make whatever their belief system is somehow superior or better than everybody else's belief system, but it doesn't make the system better. So it's hard for me to connect with political arguments, and so I guess that's where kind of where I have that disconnect. I don't really connect into the argument. I can connect into the need for justice. I can connect into the need for compassion, and I can see the need to stop abuses. I just can't define the parties that create all of these problems, in the sense that I don't think there are any innocent parties, if that makes any sense. So from my perspective, I don't really think humanity needs government at all. I think it's an imposition on the natural state of where humanity would be. Without government, I think we'd be in a much better place entirely.
I see what you're saying, and yeah. I think that at the heart of it all, as human beings, we just want to live our lives.
Exactly.
And you know, the rest of it, you know, so what? We just want to live our lives and be healthy, and you know,
yeah, be healthy, happy, have food to eat, a roof over our heads,
yes, be able to sustain life,
sustain our lives, and have our relationships, and that would be the end of it.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. I had an interesting guest on the Heart of Mind show in the afternoon who has this concept of the minimum energetic requirements for each human being should be guaranteed to each human being globally.
Mm-hmm.
So that wherever you are, you know, everyone should have these things as inalienable rights. Mm-hmm. And I think that I agree with that. And that, you know, a person's ability to sustain themselves should not be connected to the economy, in the sense that, you know, people shouldn't be exploited for their basic human needs. And I kind of agree with that.
I totally agree with that.
I don't know how to get to that system, but it's a really interesting and important concept for us to be able to integrate, that it isn't about, you know, who has the right political system, as far as I'm concerned. It's more about acknowledging that no matter what the political or religious system a person happens to belong in, that they're still a human being like you, with the same basic needs, wants, and desire to just live their lives.
Absolutely.
In a holistic way. And so it's hard for me to know how to intersect with politics coming from the perspective of spirituality. Sometimes it's more difficult because a person happens to be affiliated with a party that I'm affiliated with, if they're a crook, they're still a crook. And if a person is in a party that I would not natively acknowledge or want to be a part of, could actually be a very ethical person. So if we could switch from ideology to really being able to see the person, I think we would be in a much better shape.
And I think that, again, over the years, once in a while, having a conversation when I've been out socializing, mm-hmm. with someone who, well, at least, you know, nominally was on the other spectrum or other side of the spectrum politically, I think I've learned the most, because we actually were able just to, it didn't matter, really. You're just having a conversation and you're just mm-hmm. appreciating each other,
yeah.
as people. It's like a zebra hanging out with, I don't know, a horse. It really doesn't matter. And you sit and you talk. I mean, neither of us, you know, has our finger on the red button to make any humongous
catastrophes
in the world. So this is just purely conversation. But there are, it's, I think it's important to understand another point of view. You may disagree with certain points, but that's okay. I mean, the world's big enough so we can disagree and still live our lives.
Yeah.
But those moments have been very enlightening. And we can all be nice to each other and maybe, you know, see the world somewhat differently or, you know, but that's all right.
Yeah, I think it is all right. And but there is that, there does need to be that common thread of being able to respect another person.
Yes.
Of being able to offer kindness or a hand up or, you know, to have compassion and to elevate ourselves to a state where we can function and feel good about ourselves without needing to diminish someone else in order for that to happen. And to me, that's where a lot of the problems in the human family arise, in issues of self-esteem, issues of not being able to feel good about oneself or needing to be right in order to feel good about oneself. So if you are have a state of understanding that you must be right in order to feel good about yourself, then you will naturally go about your life making other people wrong. And so I think a lot of the issues we face in the world come about because of self-esteem, lack of self-esteem.
And over the weekend, I had a conversation with a young gentleman, and we were talking about something similar to this. And he was saying that his father was been a psychoanalyst, and he did a lot of work in the community. And one thread that he found throughout in his work was a sense of how humiliation affects people, and experiencing that, and what that does to them, you know, at an early age, and how that can haunt you for the rest of your life.
And I do believe that a lot of the power brokers use this basic knowledge as a mechanism of oppression in communities that are in competition with them. So if you think in terms of, you know, you can point at, you know, poverty, you can point at, go back and look at slavery, you can look at all kinds of oppressive policies. Right now it's the prison system and excessive force by the police department. But a lot of it stems around this whole issue of understanding human psychology in that way and using it as a tool or a mechanism of oppression. And what I think is really important, and you probably know this better than I because you work in public policy, that a lot of what needs to happen in communities and neighborhoods where there are, where there is crime, a lot of crime, where there is a lot of internalized violence, that a lot of the problems there are self-esteem issues, and they're imposed very often from a system that is designed to be oppressive, to impose that challenge to the self-esteem. So, for instance, the education system at this point, to me, is designed to keep young people oppressed and not have the capacity to mature into their fullness, because it's causing them to abandon the creative process, the process in which one person comes to have a sense of sovereignty about themselves and confidence in themselves, for this system of testing. Like, I always have to be approved of. I always have to pass the test. And there's no sense of cultivating the persons as a human being, their full capacity as a human being. So it's a system designed to create massive amounts of oppressible people, is how I'm looking at our current education system. It's not on a mass scale enriching children's lives.
Yeah, I mean, that with the development of this particular, this system, it occurs to me that actually this is not about education at all. This is not about the students at all.
No.
This is about reaching a quota. That someone tells a teacher, you have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Come hell or high water, you have to make this happen or else we're firing you.
Right.
So the student really has very little other than the vessel in which, you know, that has to sort of respond, you know, the proper way to get the right grades, but that the computer reads correctly. It's really not about the student, which is what you're saying.
Yeah, and it's not about the teachers either, because the good teachers are the ones that will be fired, and the ones that are going to be there with the students are those people who have bought into the system of testing.
Yeah.
And so it becomes almost a double whammy, because the teachers are going to be very dumb after a while if they don't have to know anything.
True.
Themselves, all they have to do is know how to give a test and correct the answer.
That's true, and I think that, I think one of the most valuable things that a teacher can give a student is the ability for the student to teach themselves.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that teachers themselves, because I know of a lot of very valiant teachers in
so
the system
I.
right now,
yeah,
who are struggling against this and trying to figure out how to compensate and give the children what they need.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, that won't be there. These teachers will either retire out or they'll be fired out for, you know, trying to do something creative in a school. And the people who will be there won't actually be teachers. They'll just be testers.
Hmm.
And so, you know, the system, if not challenged, is not going to get a lot better. And one of the reasons I'm even thinking about this is because the only ones really who can challenge this are the parents. The parents, I think, have to be the ones to get involved and say, this is not acceptable.
It depends on the parents you have.
Well, it does, but this is a step that, you know, because I think people have to look at what they can do to make a difference. So I know that there were big protests today in the city, protesting violence. Police violence, state violence. And, you know, that's one action that people can do. And a lot of people got involved in that here in Baltimore. There were a lot of people involved in that. But I think that there are proactive things that people can do. Because from my perspective, I've seen people protesting since the 60s. And it makes a marginal difference. But with the protests, I've also seen the escalation of violence against protesters. So it has less of an impact. So I think we have to come up with different strategies for making changes. And I'm hoping that people, because a person is in a low economic bracket, they have to work hard hours, doesn't mean that they don't want to do the best for their children. They still do.
Absolutely.
And so, and I think that we have to begin to figure out how we can bring our resources together so that parents can have an impact on the system again. They used to. And even though our economic situation is very oppressive and it's difficult, I really think that we have to take it to another level and find a way for parents to come together to be able to change this system. Maybe we have to copy what the kids do with their texting and their phones. You know, maybe there needs to be some kind of campaign that parents can engage in which they all do like a texting campaign or an email campaign or something where a particular government official would be the receiver of all of these texts and emails, letting them know that their constituency is not going to keep them in office if they don't. You know, so I'm just saying that there needs to be something else people can do, that people have to find the fortitude, the inner fortitude, to begin to change some of the things that are taking place. And the same thing is true with the police violence, excessive force. You know, people have got to find the inner fortitude and to come together in a peaceful way that's going to challenge the power brokers. They're the ones that are keeping these systems in place. The mayors, the council people, the borough presidents, the president. You know, these are the ones, they're keeping these systems in place. And what happens is that because our political system is based on economics, those with a lot of money start, you know, pay big money for campaigns. And the only way to change that is for each of us as individuals to step out of that and let them pay the big money, but not be bought off by the slick campaigns, and begin to start real campaigns for change. You think that's possible?
I don't know, because it depends on who runs the airwaves. So who runs the airwaves has the largest amount of reach.
Yes and no. Yes and no, this is true. But this is why they're trying to crack down on the internet, because nobody runs the internet, really.
Yeah.
And so while we still have the internet, it can be done without the mainstream media.
I hope so.
Well, let's hope so. Anyway, we've been yakking it up for a while. The number here is 212-209-2900. And I would remind you that next week the fund drive begins here at WBAI. And it is rumored that as of Friday we're going to be operating out of 388 Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. For the foreseeable future. We don't know really for sure how it's all going to happen. But I can promise you that we will be in Fund Drive for at least 4 weeks, maybe five. So you won't have too many chances to call in with your thoughts and opinions. So please take advantage of this opportunity and say hello to us here at WBAI. Hello, you are in the air.
Hi, let me just turn off my radio.
Okay. And this is WBAI in New York. Hello, go right ahead. What is your name?
Hi, this is Austin from Jersey.
Hi, Austin, go ahead.
Hi, Catherine. Is this Pauline again? Or?
Yes,
Paulette.
Hi. Yeah, I called last week, so here I am again. You folks raised some very interesting stuff, and I'm on board with this, what Catherine is saying here, in large part. You know, I think it's funny that when these things happen, these terrible things, which happen all the time, they're always recorded. Now they are recorded, and we see this horrible brutality, and we understand there'll be outrage. And it bothers me that there's so many, the people who try to deny this kind of thing are the people who fuss budget over arguing over the specifics and the technicalities of individual events. You know, I already know that that's a person I don't want to have a conversation with. The person tries to argue, well, you know, I don't want to mock an accent because that's going to get it. I could do that, but I'm not going to go there.
Thank you.
A working class kind of Archie Bunker accent. Let me not take the cheap shot. Let me not go there. But there's a certain type of mentality that gets it. Well, you know, if they were in the car and the police were, I'm saying, folks, whatever happened in a specific incident, whether you're justified or not, you're missing the point of the overarching historical scope and continuity of brutality. So, you know, you know how people say don't let the facts get in the way, and they say it sarcastically?
Yeah.
Well, I say it realistically. I say don't let the facts get in the way, because facts are just something that document very specific things and very often a bigger overarching reality anyway. So if you're going to fixate on facts, over specific incidents and then negate the bigger historical continuity of brutality, systemic brutality, not just by police, but by culture, by society, by the exploitation of people who make money off the backs of the peoples that are enslaved. You're missing the point. You're fuss budgeting over a very specific thing. So I'll make one more point on this, and then hope you get back to me on this. I think people who often say, well, you know, let's agree to disagree, is kind of a sort of loaded, toxic thing, too. Because sometimes I think, what are we disagreeing upon? Because we're not even meeting to begin with. If you're disagreeing, that means that you're understanding. Sometimes people are so talking past each other that it's kind of fatuous to say, let's agree to disagree, because that presupposes that people are even talking in the same key.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. That's one way of looking at it. But I think if you look at, I can understand to let's agree to disagree from the perspective of, it's like a detente. It's a detente. It's a way of stopping the fight, of stopping the argument. Right. You know, we're just not going to come eye to eye on this, so why are we arguing? What's the point? So you go your separate ways, and so it's a de-escalation. It can be a de-escalation, sure. And that's how I view that kind of thing. But you're right, there is that other part where it's very hard to have a conversation with someone who doesn't have the perspective, the bigger picture. And I don't know the answer to that, but conflict is not the answer. I do know that much.
Yeah, and may I say something else, Kevin?
Yeah.
I also think that there's this situation where you're talking about the conflict and the people protesting, that protesting has its place, but there's also something to be said about the limitations of it, because... Mm-hmm. And God, this is people going to be a lot of BI people going to get ticked off me for saying this, but there's this thing about the protest being the be-all, end-all, and then there's the follow-up activities which are necessary, and also there are people who quietly do things behind the scenes that are not at a protest for whatever reason. It's overwhelming to them, or they have a different way of sustaining or being supporting of people, and to minimize those people is wrong.
I agree with you 100%, yeah. Actually.
So do I.
Totally.
I totally agree with that. Thank you for your call. Did you want to respond?
Thanks for having the program.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, it calls to mind friendships I've had with people who were politically on the completely opposite end of the spectrum, but we respected each other as people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we talked about certain topics, it was like, uh-oh. But as people, we could sit and have dinner together and have a good time together, understanding that we just saw the world somewhat differently.
Hmm. We have two more calls standing by. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you? Good night. I just want to add just a little thing. The protest that they should do is stop buying at the big stores. They will get their point across. Don't you think?
I do think so. I think we have to stop spending money.
Yes.
Absolutely. We'll make a world of difference.
Yes.
Stop spending money and stop buying into the slick ads for the political candidates would solve a lot of things.
Not only that, the big stores. Because if they stop buying at those big stores, that's the way they should protest. Then somebody will speak to somebody and they'll get the point across. Not by looting and doing what they're doing. Because guess what? They are expecting them to do the looting. So they have to change their pattern.
Well, you're right about that. And a lot of people got arrested today, and people are getting arrested. So it's just an escalation of the problem. Good, very good point. Thank you.
Okay, have a good night.
You
bye-bye.
Too. Bye-bye. Yeah, we could stop spending money and buying a lot of these products that support violence. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening. How are you tonight? Oh, good morning now.
Yes, good morning.
Oh, I'm going to come at it from a different side because I love to listen to all different points of view on the radio, and I will say that I am a retired lieutenant from the New York City Police Department, and I say that proudly. I work with some of the most compassionate, caring, and brave individuals of all races and sexes My son is presently on a police department. My father was a policeman. I was raised to be a compassionate person. And as I look back on my 20 years in this city, I know I worked in some very rough neighborhoods and did the very best I could and treated everyone with respect and dignity and did my best to protect the weakest in South society from the vultures. And I don't understand how the police can be stereotyped when I know that having worked in minority neighborhoods, that 99% of the people in those neighborhoods were law-abiding, upstanding people who supported the police, supported their mission, and just wanted to go on with their life, and that the very small fraction of people in a neighborhood were criminals, just like the very small fraction of police officers are rude and, you know, noxious and maybe up to no good. But the overwhelming number of policemen and the most overwhelming number of people in these communities are good people. And I don't like the stereotype on either side.
Well, you know what? I agree with you. As a matter of fact, I came from a family similar to yours. My eldest brother was a policeman. I had about four uncles who were in the police force. And what I have seen, though, that it's not, you know, in many ways, the police force, like we were speaking about, the teachers are being molded into a system that is corrupt. And I think it's a lot of similarities in that ever since the September 11th event, the police force has been gradually militarized. And there has been a very different impact of that militarization on people and on communities. And the problem is complicated by the fact that the justice system is not providing justice when a police officer does something that, from the perspective of the victim or the person in the community, appears to be wrong. So when a police officer, even if the person is a criminal, if they did something wrong, they're running from you, is it ethical to shoot them under those circumstances in the back?
Well, I don't know what incident you're talking about.
This is a different incident. But all I'm saying is that I agree with you in terms of the police, the cop on the beat, the regular police force. By and large, the percentage of police officers who are good people are as high as the percentage of human beings that you see in the neighborhood. Good people just trying to live their lives, do their jobs the best they can. I agree with you there. I think the stereotyping is unfortunate, but I believe that the problem is as much the justice system, the court system, that no matter what the circumstances are, there's never, from my perspective, there's never even a chance, a prayer, or, you know, it doesn't even, you know, there doesn't ever really seem to be any stopping of the aggressive, the excessive aggression that has taken place over the last few years. There just seems to be no answer for people. What do you say to people who feel that no matter what happens, no matter how they're treated, they're never going to find any justice in our justice system? Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, you there? Yeah,
I would say that the justice system is flawed on many parts, and just because the police, for instance, Freddie Gray was a menace to the black community in which he lived. The police, on the complaints of the minority citizens of Baltimore, arrested him 25 times for selling drugs to the children of Baltimore. He should have been incarcerated or something. Something failed that he was arrested 25 times and was allowed to be out selling drugs to children in Baltimore 2 weeks ago. That's failing.
Yeah, that's a big failure.
That's a big failure. Because remember, he went from a drug dealer on the street to a hero because of this incident. Let's call him what he was. Even though no one deserves to be died, now we have reports coming out that the other prisoner in the van, who happens to be black, and was interviewed immediately upon Freddie's arrival at the police station, said, is now reporting and signed paperwork at the scene that Freddie was bashing his head into the wall in the police truck. So now all of a sudden the facts are going to come out. Now, if the facts come out that these officers did not do anything wrong, then that's justice. The fact in Missouri was that that officer was on patrol. He heard of a robbery. He stopped Mr. Brown in the street, and the situation escalated, and the scientific proof backed the officer's statement. Justice was served to the officer. Just because the person who ends up being killed by the police officer gets justice too. If you don't like the results, that doesn't mean justice wasn't served. Yes, there are incidents when it doesn't appear that justice was served. There are, I know there's many incidents where police officers have gone to jail when they were acting outside their scope of employment and doing things that they knew were criminal. But in the heat of a moment, if I have a 20-year record of being a good guy and serving my community well, and at 3 o'clock in the morning in an alley, I think a man has a gun and it turns out to be a flashlight, and I make one wrong decision, do I go to jail for this? I was doing my best. I was doing my best with no ill intent. The police officer in Cleveland who wrote up on a guy, I don't like the officer's tactics, who shot the 14-year-old kid with the pellet gun. But when you listen to the 911 calls and people were saying there's a kid in the park with a gun and the police officer pulls up, I don't agree with the officer for doing it. I don't agree with him getting, but I don't, but he did, the officer did not start the situation, did not, and when 24 reasonable people sat down in the grand jury and listened to the evidence and listened to the law, they decided that the officer hadn't committed a crime. A crime is a very serious thing, and you need a mental state, whether it's intentional, reckless, or negligent. Just because you do something doesn't make it a crime. You can disagree with what happened. You can disagree with with the officer in Missouri saying, well, he could have done something else when a 300-pound man who had just committed a robbery was charging at him after he beat him, after he beat the officer in the car and tried to pull a gun out and the gun discharged. Now you were expecting the officer to do something else other than defend himself. Well he may disagree, you know, with it, but he was legally entitled, and the 24 people that did the grand jury said, well, you know what? We're going to come down to starting the guy who started that day being a good human being, a good police officer. We're not going to start with the guy who started the day by robbing the bodega of the cigar.
Okay. You've had your say. I think you've had your say, and I understand where you're coming from.
I appreciate you letting me speak.
I do understand where you're coming from. I happen not to agree with everything that you're saying, but I do understand where you're coming from. Thank you for your call. Very interesting. Let's see. Somebody was on hold here, but I think I lost them. What do you think about that?
What do I think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's making a point when you look at certain individual cases, but like our first caller was saying, when you look at the overarching history of violence that's being perpetrated against young black people, young black men primarily, but black youth, I think that there's a deeper problem than to say that this or that person was a criminal, so therefore it's okay to shoot them.
Yeah, but I also think that no one walks around with the word criminal on their forehead. Shooting someone and then running afterwards to justify what you did as if you have some sort of telepathic power to know who this person is, I don't really think is an argument. And I don't think having the sort of latitude to say, well, you know, I was emotionally charged, I could never get away with saying such a thing and
doing
to someone.
Nobody can.
And walk away and say, well, you know, it was just my emotion.
I was afraid, so therefore it's okay.
Yeah, I don't think life is that cheap, and I don't think that serving and protecting someone should be so based on how well your day is going. And as I say, you know, using the argument, and we've seen this in New York politics forever, to harm someone and then run quickly to check to see whether or not they were a bad or good person, and then use that as sort of reversed some sort of weird kind of consequence that, you know, you're their karma, I think is really illogical. And I see, you know, we've all seen that all the time.
From the perspective of a human being, I do understand what this man was saying in terms of, you know, police officers go into the police force overall for good intentions. And they're good human beings and they want to do their jobs. But I've, from my perspective, the police force has been militarized and programmed in such a way that they over-respond, overreact to every possible concern and possible fear. And there is a violence that is permitted. And I say this because I've witnessed it. You know, I've seen a person shot. I lived in the South Bronx. And I saw cops, you know, running after this, you know, a car chase in the city streets. Dozens of police cars against this one car. I don't know what the person did. But when the policeman got out of his car, he got out of his car with his gun and he shot the person in the car. There was no questioning. There was nothing. There was just a surrounding of the car and a shooting of the person who was in the car. I witnessed it. And I've also witnessed violence in the transit system. Somebody's jumping the fare. Do you really need six police to stomp that person to the ground? You know, it's so, you know, so it's like it's because of the combination of escalation of petty crimes and the escalation of violence within the police force and brutality being permitted within the police force has come to brought us to this state where violence is being perpetrated. And it isn't just, from my perspective, though I recognize the humanity of police officers, that they be allowed to lose their humanity through this brutal behavior.
I agree with what you're saying. And I also absolutely recognize the importance of the, well, the humanity of everyone, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... I remember once my mother was the victim of a crime, and she was thrown down a flight of stairs. Mm-hmm. So we had to call the police, and I went to the precinct. And when I saw all of the pictures of, like, the corpses and all these things, and I realized that police have to actually see, I thought, my goodness, you know.
Yeah.
How hard it must be to actually have to face that side of humanity for a living. So I certainly appreciate that. I was around police officers who are part of the community affairs, and they deal with domestic violence a lot. And a lot of times you hear, you know, what happens when they show up at someone's house. But I was I gave a forum on domestic violence, and the police showed up. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, an officer came up to me and thanked me so much for organizing this, that he got so much out of the experience. So I think there are people who are in it for, you know, whatever that motivates them to have to look at, as they say, sometimes the worst side of humanity, and just sort of plow through it and to try to be helpful. I'm not saying that those people don't exist, and I do appreciate them. Because mm-hmm. God forbid something happens to either one of us.
Yeah.
You know, who are you going to call? But the psychological effect of over militarizing is as if you're in a war zone and you're the enemy. It wears down on the strength of a community, and it's. I don't know exactly how to describe it.
And it traumatizes the children.
It, very much so.
Hello, you're on the air. Are you there? Yes. Sorry.
Yeah, I like how you were just talking about the militarization of this. Because I was watching today on the news, and they were showing the head police officer from Baltimore. And he's talking about, well, we send resources to this part of the town and resources to this other part of the town. Yeah. And he sounds just like a military general. I mean, where are we at? I mean,
we can't even say, oh, well, no, we sent officers down to this part of the town. They don't even talk about the officers like they're human beings. No, they're like warriors. And this gentleman who spoke before, I totally don't understand where he's at. It doesn't matter what type of crime this gentleman did. He died in some police car, got injured or whatever. It doesn't matter what his crime is. It's what happened to the young guy. And this is the point of disconnect with what some people are talking about with this. It's just a sad, sad thing. And people need to, I think people do need to stand up and need to voice their distaste for what is going on in these police forces. It's like they're taking it to war. And
this is what I was trying to tell, you know, the retired police officer, that these things are occurring as a matter of policy, top-down policy, and the police officers are in a system in which they are being permitted to have excessive force in our neighborhoods, and because they're so in, I don't know what goes on in the training process, but there's something I don't understand why a person who has very often a machine gun, police, you know, a bulletproof vest, other weapons around them, many police officers in surrounding them as well, are so afraid of a 18, 20-year-old kid. I don't get it. What is there to be afraid that you feel the need to use deadly force?
Oh, it's, you know, I always tell everybody, I'm a white person, okay? And I'm driving down the road. I get pulled over by a police officer. That is the most dangerous situation I'm in. And I shouldn't feel that I'm in a dangerous situation. Getting pulled over, like if say I'm speeding, I get pulled over. I, in my mind, I know I'm in a dangerous situation. I make one false move as that police officer comes up to my car and I put down my window. He has his hand on his gun and he's ready to blow you away.
Yeah.
And that's the disconnect, is they believe everybody is out to get, you know, I don't know. I feel sorry for this young gentleman. I feel sorry for the people in Baltimore. And it's a real sad state of affairs of what's going on in our inner cities and this country. Hey, thank you for your time.
All right, thank you for your call. And let's see, we have another caller standing by. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
Yes,
you're on the air.
Yeah, see, the problem with all of this is that people are just spouting opinions and all of this. There is a such thing as law. The New York State Penal Code law books use it when a person commits a, quote, crime. This is where the police go in and charge you with first degree felony, Class A, Class B. All police officers, when they graduate the academy, they take an oath to uphold the Constitution of New York State and protect the citizens therein. Anytime an officer commits an act that violates this, everything that they do afterwards is no longer, they're criminals because they violated their oath. If the entire precinct backs this, then the RICO statute can come into effect, okay? Which means that they're an organized gang. If you're a police officer and you see another police officer committing a crime and you do nothing about this, then that's a criminal act. That's known as a conspiracy. If two people get in a car and go for a drive and one person says, I'm going to go get a pack of cigarettes and robs a grocery store and kills an individual, then they both are going to be charged with the crime of first-degree murder. Second point, that guy that was talking all that nonsense about the guy was killed, all these black people that were killed, he was justifying a police action. Police are not judge, jury, and executioner. Okay? That's the first thing. If that's the case, then why have you ever heard about John Gotti his soldiers and lieutenants, these are organized criminals, white criminals. Why aren't they being gunned down and brutalized by the police department if they're so gung-ho about crime? You know, you never hear that.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to bring this point up. It's all, and why is it always white police officers that are in fear of their life? They had a riot out in the Jewish community a few years ago. And they completely destroyed a police car, set fire to garbage cans and threw them at the cops, yet not one person was arrested. One of our reverends, Reverend Daltrey, has documented since 1970 in the Jewish community, they have put 120 police officers in the hospital and completely destroyed three precincts, but yet no one was ever arrested for these things. Also, why is it that when protesters are out protesting, protesters have to be peaceful and nonviolent, but yet in Israel, they have a right to exist, they have a right to defend themselves, right? Three Jewish kids are killed, and they go on a war path and destroy like half of a city in Palestine and kill like over 4,000 people, but yet no politician in this country tells them to be nonviolent, to be peaceful in their actions and all of this stuff. See what I'm saying? These are criminal behaviors that people, every black man in New York City needs to carry the New York State Penal Code law book. So when they're stopped and asked to show ID, they need to pull this book out because these police are doing criminal acts. And whenever they're being charged with anything, they always want to remove the criminal aspect and take it into the civil realm. This is why nobody's being arrested for this.
Oh.
You know, you were right. This is the problem, like with the Al Sharptons. They take things out of the criminal realm. The medical examiner said that the brother in Staten Island was murdered. So instead of protesting and talking about I can't breathe and all this other nonsense, right? Get the penal code law book, go to first degree murder, call out the police officer's name and say this is what he's being charged with, out of the book. Okay? So now you can't ignore this. If you do, then you will see that there is no law. If the system does not respect its own law, then there is anarchy and chaos. Because how can you take an oath to uphold the law and then, in fact, you are committing a crime? I'll give you an example. I was riding my bike once, and there was a police car that was triple parked in front of a fire hydrant. So the police officer called me over and said, oh, let me see some ID. I'm going to give you a ticket. And I said, for what? And she said, you're riding against traffic. And I'm like, wait a minute. What law am I violating under the penal code law book? And she's like, oh, you being a smart ass. So I gave her my ID. And I, in turn, gave her a ticket because I counted off how many feet she was in front of the fire hydrant. And she's triple parked.
Wow.
So she, in effect, calls for backup. 20 police show up in 5 police cars. One of the cops went over to her car and asked her what this was about. And he cursed her out and said, what the hell you call us here for this nonsense for? The cop came over to me and said, listen, forget about this. She in turn gives me the ticket. When I go to court and give them the summons, they go on the computer and say she never filed it. Because she knew that if she had to go to court to testify, she was going to have to explain why she was violating the law, triple parked in front of a fire hydrant. What if there was a fire?
Mm.
You see, we keep going into the civil realm with this. Cops, you just can't blatantly do anything because you're not judge, jury, and executioner. You have to follow the law. And if you violate the law, then you need to be charged with a crime.
Excellent point. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Okay, we have some more listeners with their thoughts standing by. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Yes.
Thanks for allowing me to share. The last caller mentioned, how come the cops are not shooting down certain gangster people or things like this. My opinion to that, or my answer to that would be, is because if these people felt it was very unjust, they're not going to stop. They don't stop until justice is served against the people who did it. The majority of those people If something happened that it's shown that it was unnecessary force or anything like that, they're not going to stop. And so the powers that be or those people, they know this. So that's one answer to that. I'm not going to say it's in all cases, but they would not stop.
So, are you saying that the people would retaliate?
Let me put it to you this way. I'm Italian. If somebody killed my nephew and I found out unequivocally that it was a murder, justice is going to be served. One way or the other, we don't stop.
So in other words, you don't advocate for the peaceful response?
If it's not going to work, right? What did Malcolm X say? All right, so that's one thing I'd like to say. That's what I've seen.
Is that they couldn't get away with it.
If the legal system doesn't work, they're not going to get away with it. Eventually, something's going to happen. Okay,
And I'm not endorsing that, but I'm.
It's my opinion. I'm a caller. Yeah, not your opinion of the show. I'm an independent. You know, so I want to say that. But I got to tell you, when the gentleman, the guy who shot those police officers, and he gave his reasons why, you didn't see much happening for weeks, right? You didn't see any brutality pretty much happening or any other murders for weeks, maybe even like a couple of months, right? So if you're going to push people and you're going to bully people, someday somebody's going to stand up to you. And that's what's going to happen. Now, another thing I'd like to point out is around that time that it happened with the choking of Gardner in Staten Island, there was this whole thing going on with the police and the sergeants and contracts and the mayor's office. So, like I said, around that time, these are boys with big toys. And so they were pouting about a contract. So I feel that they were extra rough on the street. They didn't care, because you can put two and two together with the fact that then they turned their back on him and all this. So again, these guys go around and it's all about their job and their overtime. I was arrested once, and all these two cops talked about all night was their overtime and salary and who was here. So I witnessed things differently. And this is what I witnessed. And when I was in jail in southern Manhattan, most of the people were in there were African-Americans, and they were busted for pot, you know. So that was my experience I like to share. Earlier today, I was listening to AM radio, last point, and they were talking about Dinkins and compared to Giuliani. So he says, oh, this was an AM radio or in the morning, like 10 a.m., 9 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying, well, when you know, with one thing Dinkins didn't do, and he's a friend of mine, and he's a gentleman, one of the finest people I know, and all this. But one thing he didn't do in his administration is he didn't do what Giuliani did, and he just didn't do it. And what Giuliani did was he had 2,000 cops at a demonstration. And then he had his tactics and his people. He had 2,000 cops waiting, hiding, to back them up. And then he had 2,000 cops at home, ready to go. So this is their mentality. So I would suggest, if you're going to protest, you have to change your tactics. Go protest, have something start in one place, and then the majority of 3/4 of the people go somewhere else, like Long Island, where you might say, well, why? You know, go to Long Island, because that's where the cops live. That's where the cops' wives and families are. You know, go disturb the commerce there. In all the stuff that happened downtown in Wall Street, I went down there on purpose to say, why are you protesting here in a closet, so to speak? Go on Park Avenue. Go close that park down. And they kind of looked at me with like three heads. Well, you go do it. And I'm like, well, I'm by myself. So
it's just like this thing where I heard with Giuliani, and like they got this plan and all this. Look at their mentality. So go somewhere else. Go close down another place. I was happy to see people running down Madison at night, but they needed to do different with the last protest that happened. But, you know, you got to follow Malcolm X, I think, you know. And he said, you know, justice may happen one way or the other. And a bully pushes you, eventually you're going to push back.
Well, thank you for your perspective. I appreciate that. All right. Different tactics. I don't know about the pushing back thing, but I do understand it. I understand. Oh, we lost our caller. I had you on hold, and apparently either disconnected or something. We have maybe 5 minutes for another call at 212-209-2900. Interesting perspective. I wouldn't advise that perspective for black people, in the sense that we don't have that power that the Italians have in terms of having that organization behind them. We don't have that. And I just wouldn't advise it. I don't think it would work. I don't think it would work. But, and I'm nonviolent, so I don't think it's a good idea.
I'm nonviolent also.
In that it turns us into a manifestation of the thing that we're trying to prevent. So I don't see the advantage or the percentage in that. Wow, four calls. We're going to have to go very fast, please. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes. If I would like to respond to...
Very quickly, please. We're running out of time.
Okay. If black people do not organize themselves, right, as far as being like Italians, you know what I mean, then they are susceptible as individuals, because Italians act as a group, and black people act as individuals, and they are getting...
You make a good point, yeah.
And that's, you know, that's the thing. And the other thing, the main thing is that the injustice thing, right? If you look at the way the police system is designed, right, it is designed to attack black people. And all the police laws during Reagan's time, right, as far as gun control, was aimed at groups like the Panthers and stuff, who openly carry guns out in the open for self-defense. You know, so that's
okay.
All I have to say.
Thank you. We got to run. Let's see. I think we have one caller coming through at the moment, and we'll be the last. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, well, I would just like to say I'm glad there's this, a discussion about this topic. It's been a very long time, because the commercial medium doesn't really cover African-American issues, so I appreciate your program. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's very, very kind. Could you? Let's see. Maybe I could take another call before we get make room for Hour of the Wolf. Hello, you're on the air.
I'm on the air.
You are on the air. Did you want to say something on the air?
Yes, ma'am, I do.
Okay. Please go ahead.
You know what? I think the divide and conquer is a little bit too old for us as people, as African Americans, and I think it's well more deep-rooted than you can ever admit. I'm just sorry that we have to live our life in this lifetime and still suffer from this, that it started in slavery. And you know what? I don't know how many more years or hundreds of years that we have to wake up to this divide and conquer situation that we are suffering. But I please would like to see my next generation get over it. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And I think we are. I think we're moving in that direction. No more. He was again worried about divide and conquer. What happens in the black community is one of divide and conquer. I think there's a lot of unity at this point. I don't think that we have come upon a successful strategy. But I do feel that there is unity. I mean, that goes beyond the black community. They were people of all colors protesting against some of this violence, and I've seen that more and more. So there's a lot of unity around it. I'm not sure that we've found the correct strategy on what we can do to make a difference. So let's see. We have one lonely caller trying to say a word. Hello, you're on the air?
Yeah, let me turn the radio down.
Okay, please, very quickly, we're on our way out the door. You're listening to WBAI
in New
York. Yeah,
this is a real serious problem, and if we don't want to see cities burning down like in Baltimore, which it becomes inevitable, we need to start to deal with it. Those who didn't hear Mimi's program need to hear Stephen Janis of, I believe, the Real News Network. He explained that over a particular period with a O'Malley mayor, 100,000 people were arrested each year of a 600,000 population, which is extraordinary. The NAACP finally took a lawsuit. Officially, 35% arrests were totally illegal, and he said probably about 50%. A seven-year-old was arrested for sitting on a dirt bike.
Is this in Baltimore?
Yes. And what's so extraordinary about this is you have these guys who identify as being whites, which is how they start out with that delusion, and they are sadistic, they're brutal, and it's become normalized that they can crush a person's spine. It's obvious that they had already crushed his neck, his spine, when they were dragging him off to the van. He hadn't done anything. They still haven't told us why he was being arrested. And Stephen explained that they have something called the jump out boys. First of all, the whole system has been designed for us. We're the father of the system. That's why Michelle Alexander wrote her book. And they jump out, they sweep up people because they get overtime for that. And in 06, they got 40 million overtime. They get 8 extra hours once they get 5 arrests per day. And as for the drugs, the U.S. brings in, the CIA and such brings in the drugs. It's not a war against people because so-called whites actually use drugs at the same rate or more. If they did stop and frisk at Columbia, NYU, or Wall Street, they'd get things like much more cocaine and much more of the drugs and the so-called contraband. And that doesn't happen. So there's so many issues. We probably need to stop dealing with these white people coming into our communities, living elsewhere, and deal with what real community policing it is. It's a disgrace. It's unbelievable. It's outrageous. And I don't agree with anything that the retired police officer said. It's a system that when you incarcerate these 100,000 people a year in those communities, they come back, they've gone through the system, they can't vote, they can't get jobs. So you're literally making them even more powerless. Casinos were built up in downtown Baltimore and hotels, and those poor people are actually subsidizing as their basketball court for 17 years is dilapidated. Even when a nonprofit group tried to raise monies and do it on their own, the city was not cooperative. And these people live in such conditions that at some point they realize that they are really under fascism and oppression, and the cities are going to burn down. So we need to come up with some real solutions.
Well, very powerful. Thank you for your points, your perspective. Very powerful. Thank you. And there's truth to that. She could have been talking about Tulia, Texas, in a way.
Easily.
Yeah, and it's in. So maybe Tulia, Texas, was the test case for moving it to the big city of Baltimore, where they're just wholesale arresting and depriving people of their lives. So, but it isn't. It's a system, it's a top-down system. These decisions are made very high up in the food chain. The guy, the cop, the crazy cop on the street shouldn't be on the police force. They should have been screened out. And I believe the system is such that it screens the crazy people in because they're useful. for the choice of exploiting. So obviously Baltimore is now going to become upscale, so they need to move the black people out. Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay, we're just about out of time. You're listening to Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine Davis with
Paulette Spencer.
And coming up will be Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund standing by. For those of you who would communicate, you can reach me, Catherine, at my email, heartofmindradio@gmail.com. heartofmindradio@gmail.com. And Paulette, you're using the Night Report?
Yes, I am.
@gmail.com.
Yes, I am.
So you could write to either of us if you have some thoughts or opinions. And for those of you, despite the program you heard today, I am a teacher of meditation and relaxation techniques. So for those of you who are very stressed out, please do make your contact with me. You could even go to my website, qigongonline.net, and you will find meditations there so that you can awaken your inner child, breathe, relax, and return to your normal state of being. Because truthfully, we need to be, I mean, this is a real survival tool. If you can maintain your equilibrium and your state of mind in the face of potential conflict, be it with an officer of the law or otherwise, it could save your life. Because it's the trigger of you losing your cool that allows the justification of force. So when we can be calm and aware in the face of potential violence, it's a very powerful place to be.
And that's what Martin Luther King was about.
So, go there and meditate, is my advice. In the face of it all, we have to stay calm. Thank you for your participation on today's program. We expect to be back. I believe Jim Freund is doing a fundraiser next week. And then we will be back in 3 weeks doing a fundraiser. And in between, it should be Lister doing a fundraiser. So we'll see how that works. We're going to be helping each other out and depending on you to sustain this radio station. If you enjoyed this evening's programming or any programming, then please consider supporting WBAI during our fund drive. Stay tuned. We shall be back with the fabulous Hour of the Wolf.
And people are just too much for me to take. I climb right up to the top of the stairs, and all my cares just drift right into space. On the roof's the only place. Crowd and all that rat race noise down in the street. At night the stars put on a show for free. Smack dab in the middle of town. I found a paradise that's trouble-proof. And if this old world starts getting you down, there's room enough for two up on the
good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program occasionally dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund, with us on recording live from yesterday, as it were, from 388. We'll be right back.
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. This happens in reality, the new fictional film by director Quentin Dupieux. A TV cameraman named Jason, played by Alain Chabat, who's trying to make his debut as a director with a horror film he spent years developing, goes to a movie theater to discover the film he wants to make is already playing there. After failing to dissuade the audience that they should stop watching the film because it hasn't been made yet, Jason calls the producer whose money he's wooing, only to interrupt that producer, Bob, played by Jonathan Lambert, while he's in a meeting with Jason, the cameraman, who wants to be a director and who's presently wooing Bob to fund his film. Neither men are especially put out to discover this particular temporal anomaly, telling the first Jason that he's dreaming. Which may be so, except that when we cut back to that other Jason, he's now relocated into a scene that occurred at the beginning of the film, which in itself may be a part of another film directed by a mercurial director, played by John Glover, who's warring with his producer, Bob, played by Jonathan Lambert. And that's the way it goes with reality, a film that drives home the irony of its title with sledgehammer finesse. Dream reality folds into film reality, folds into what purports to be reality reality, until it's pointless trying to decipher which from what. Additional plot lines get thrown in. There's a TV chef, played by John Heder, whose debilitating skin condition may or may not be psychosomatic. A grade school principal, played by Eric Wareheim, who's a closet transvestite. A TV pun that may or may not be intentional. And a young girl, who happens to be named Reality, played by Kyla Kennedy, who's on a quest to watch a videotape she found in the belly of a wild pig her father killed. And if you can guess what's on that videotape, you win nothing, because it's pretty obvious what's on that tape. I mean, come on, let's not kid ourselves. Now, the director, Quentin Dupieux, who started out as an electronic musician before moving to film, has caught critical flack in the past, mostly being accused of being irredeemably self-indulgent. And it's not an unfair accusation. Subtlety is not his strong suit, clearly. Performances are broad, and despite the fact that the film is set in Hollywood, about half the characters speak French. At least part of the film may be Dupieux's commentary on the Hollywood film system and his own experiences in the industry. The movie Jason wants to make is about megalomaniacal television sets who can make people's heads explode, which sounds a lot like the plot of a previous Dupieux film, Rubber, which was about a megalomaniacal tire that could make people's heads explode. But it's kind of hard to decipher what he wants to say about the film industry or the nature of film itself. That may in fact be deliberate. It may be just what it is, what you see on screen, a Mobius strip of a story that's just there to mess with your mind. Dupieux has previously established the mind bleep as his goal, most clearly in the opening of Rubber, where a character states flat out that things are going to happen for no reason. That seems to attach here as well. It's kind of a comfortable, entitled offshoot of Dada, which in its own way essentially flies in the face of Dada itself. How Dada can you get? And funny thing, I'm okay with that. I run hot and cold on Dupieux. I didn't like another film of his, Wrong, which was a little too broad and self-indulgent, even for me. But here, as with Rubber, the scrambling of realities and the sense that Dupieux is genuinely having fun messing with what a narrative should be is actually something of a rush. And I'm kind of a sucker for such moments as when young reality, the girl, looks into the camera and says, "I hate this movie," speaking both to director John Glover, who's revealed to be obsessively filming her, and to the unseen Dupieux and the audience as well, as a character frustrated with being trapped in this convoluted reality, there's that word again. Her exasperation may be Dupieux's concession to his critics, but I found reality a kick, and that's good enough. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are posting these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
And this is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And thank you, Dan Persons, for that. Okay, now we have a busy and buzzy agenda. Last night, it wasn't exactly a New York Review of Science Fiction reading, but it was under that auspices, but I called it Hour of the Wolf Live. And it was held in the location that we will be broadcasting from, our future actual studio home. Well, if we ever have an actual studio there, which is what the next fundraising drive will decide, at 388 Atlantic Avenue, where I've been holding readings, some readings for a little while. At any rate, the system there is a work in progress. Beg your pardon. And there is a major buzz in the system. So even as we speak, I am in the process of going through an exceedingly slow download that technical director for my reading series, Terrence Taylor, has put together for us. So I'm stalling right now, but I'll stall with wonderful stuff. You see, the real New York Review of Science Fiction reading series, the real one, is on the first Tuesday of every month. And so, next Tuesday, May 5th, Cinco de Mayo, I've got to go off mic, get my bag, because I want to read you some bios for Cinco de Mayo, the bio for Cinco de Mayo, because we have yet another killer lineup. Wasn't, you know, last week we had Samuel R. Delaney and Sam J. Miller. This week we had Robert Sherman, which you're about to hear, from Doctor Who, no less. And a lot more, as a matter of fact. He's done a great deal of great work. And next week, starting with Cherie Renee Thomas, curator emeritus of our reading series, editor of the book Dark Matter, essentially speculative fiction from the African diaspora, and Dark Matter Reading the Bones anthologies that won 2 World Fantasy Awards and was named New York Times Book of the Year. She is coming to us from Memphis. Ooh, I do believe the download has finished. So when I'm done doing all this talking, just give me a moment here and let me actually give it a try. Ooh, it looks like it's there. It looks like I can drop it into the box. Let me just... Are there headphones in this room? I am not going to miss this place. Even if the new place is unfinished, I'm going to prefer that to what we have had here. Come on. Oh, well, yeah. And it's not going to play unless I hit the play button, right?